Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Mary, and I'll be the host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was founded in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students for the respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here at the university, locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is The European Union, A Personal Experience, with Deputy Counsel General Stefan Biedermann. But right now, I'll introduce to you Johanna Watzinger-Tharp, the Associate Dean for International and Interdisciplinary Programs here at the College of Humanities and the Director for the International Studies Program. Please join me in welcoming our guests.
I'm very pleased to introduce Mr. Stefan Biedermann, who is not actually just a fellow German, but a fellow Franconian, basically born quite right next door to where I was born in Nuremberg, in Hof in Bavaria. Maybe the German students here can locate that, but that's in Bavaria, in this sort of region of Franconia. Mr. Biedermann studied history and Japanese studies in Berlin, Kyoto, and Tokyo, and he holds master's degrees in both disciplines. Between 1988 and 1993, Mr. Biedermann worked as a journalist, and he covered the fall of the wall and German unification for Japanese television in Berlin. He joined the Foreign Service in 1993 and has held a number of posts, starting in the Foreign Office in Berlin, 1993 to 1996. He also served as a cultural attaché in the German Embassy in Tokyo from 1996 to 2000, and as Vice Consul General in the German Consulate General in Osaka. Since July 2012, he has served as Vice Consul General in the German Consulate General in Los Angeles, and we're very pleased to have him here in Utah, and I believe that's your first time here in Utah. In his free time, Mr. Biedermann enjoys reading, guitars, music, and art history, and perhaps will add outdoor experiences to that list more in California and perhaps in Utah. We're very pleased to welcome Mr. Biedermann here, and we look forward to hearing about his personal experience in the European Union. Thank you.
So, thank you very much for inviting me. As you heard, it's my first time in Utah. It was kind of a shock because we had warm weather in Los Angeles when I went away, and I ended up here in a freezing cold. But as you mentioned, I've been born in the Bavarian countryside, and there it's even colder than here. So it's not that bad after all. The title of my presentation, as you heard, is The European Union, A Personal Experience. The personal part for me is very important, and I would like to stress that what I tell you today is my personal opinion and not necessarily the opinion of my ministry. You know us diplomats, if you get official statements from us, they are not very entertaining. And if you read our news, web page, it's also not very entertaining. So I will give you my personal opinions, and since this is being broadcast and printed, please take that as my personal opinion. The purpose why I put that on a more personal level is reading about the European Union these days is not really pleasant. First of all, of course, the media are full of bad news about the European Union. And apart from that, if you start to get a little deeper into the matter, you find out that studying the European Union, that's a difficult thing. Me, myself, being a professional diplomat, I have to admit that I do not completely understand the decision-making process that is taking place in Brussels. And if we didn't have very good media in Germany, for example, Der Spiegel, who gives very detailed information about what's happening, I myself would have the feeling that I don't exactly know what's going on, especially in these days of crisis where we have a new situation almost every day, and we have crisis meetings, and the heads of states and governments meet and try to close out everybody else to find a solution. These are interesting times, on the other hand, because things are moving. I have given presentations about the European Union quite often, and I found whenever I'm away from Europe, still, I would say, the perception of Europe in entities of national states is still very strong, also here in the United States. I suppose if I talk to you, you would say in Italy we have pasta and we have fashion and we have good ice cream. And in France you have, again, fashion and lifestyle and everything. And in London you have pop culture. And in Germany you have this and that and Schloss Neuschwanstein. But the perception as the European Union, as being one entity that is growing more and more together, I have the feeling, is still very weak. If you go to Europe, though, and if you meet Europeans, maybe of your age, and talk to them, you will find out that their everyday life is so strongly influenced of what's happening in Brussels and in the European Union, their lifestyles have changed considerably in the last 20 years. Well, I already mentioned bad news only, lots of bad news in the media in last 2 or 3 years. I thought, being the historian that I am, that again I give you an idea of what this project is basically meant to be, how it came into living, and what its basic purpose is. Because the European Union is not a monetary union in the first place. It's not even an economic union in the first place, even though in its original shape it was kind of a joint economic project. Let me just put my message in a nutshell. It is, in fact, a vision. It is even, I would say, a utopia of putting a whole continent into peace, of making war impossible for a whole continent. And if you look at the continent of Europe, it has a terrible history of war, violence, that I think is almost unique in the world for centuries. I would say the deepest point of that being reached in 1945. And it is no wonder that this project was born after 1945. To make that a little easier to understand, I would like to tell you a little bit about my family. My grandfather, Hans Biedermann, was born in 1899, still the 19th century. He was a farm boy in the province of Bavaria, Franconia, and of course everybody expected him again to become a farmer. I think he was quite an intelligent boy, but at that time it was completely unthinkable that he would go to a higher school or to university, so he stayed a farm boy. He went to basic school. And at that time, in the beginning of the 20th century, at school, he would have learned that Germany, being in the center of Europe, has a strong neighbor, that is France, and France is what we in German call our Erbfeind. Erbfeind, Erben means heritage, and Feind is the enemy. And together it is a word that means something like eternal foe. France is our eternal foe. He learned that at school. As a boy, he was convinced that Germany was a superior nation and the French were our enemy. And then in 1914, the First World War broke out. In 1917, when my grandfather became 18, he had to go into war against the French. For a farm boy at that time, you wouldn't believe it, but he has told me that personally, that was a big experience. It was his first voyage further away than 30 kilometers from his home village. He went to France. Of course, it was war, but he could see some part of the world. And better than that, he was taken prisoner by the French and then shipped to England, because England was also in war, and there he helped at the English coast. They dug out protection structures because they were afraid the Germans would maybe occupy England too. So he saw France and England as a young man, as a soldier, and to the end of his life he would talk about that. So we lost that war, as you know. We paid a heavy price for that, but you wouldn't think it made us wiser. As you know, the Germans didn't learn their lesson out of the First World War. No, they did the opposite. We thought it was unjust, and Adolf Hitler then decided to have another war. And so in 1940, my grandfather again had to go into war against the French. At that time, of course, he was not a young man anymore, so he was more into logistics, but he went to war against the French the second time in his life. So we lost that war again, as you know, in 1945. Not only that the Germans had destroyed all their neighboring countries, but Germany itself had been heavily destroyed. And I make a little jump now. My grandfather died in 1991, so he became quite old. And in the last year of his life, he witnessed a miracle because he could watch with his own eyes, on TV, of course, that the border between our eternal foe France and Germany disappeared. The border was simply taken away. So if today you, with your car, you go west from Germany on the Autobahn, you drive and drive, and all of a sudden the lining on the street changes from white into yellow, and you see the inscriptions outside change from German into French, that's all that you see. It's not much more than that. And it's not only France. It's also Italy, and it's Poland, and all the other countries around. You can call that a miracle. Within one span of a lifetime, two wars against the French, and in the end, the disappearing of the border between the two countries. So what has made this miracle possible? So I have to go back to the year 1945 and talk a little bit about the generation of my parents. My parents are born in 1934 and 35. Lucky. Very lucky. You can imagine when the war was over, they were 10 or 11 years old, so they have witnessed the war, but fortunately, they were too young to have to go themselves. My father always tells the story. He was, every young boy in Germany, was supposed to become a member of the Hitlerjugend, which was the youth organization of the Nazis. And there was a famous day where each 10 or 11-year-old boy had to give an oath. I swear that I'll do anything for Adolf Hitler, even die for him. And the day was about to come, and one day before my father had to swear this oath, the Americans came into the village. And to this very day, my father is very grateful to the Americans that he had not to take this oath. You can imagine. So my parents, if you talk to them, they remember what war means, atrocities and things like that. Or maybe let me give you that other story. One day before the Americans came into that village, my grandfather had mounted the roof of his house and had put out a little white flag because he was afraid the Americans maybe with the tanks might shoot or something, and he wanted that the farm being not demolished. So he put out a little white flag. But at that time, in the woods around this village, there were still some German soldiers, and especially the SS men, fanatics in a way, who hid during daylight in the forests and in the evenings came down into the villages to get some food from the farmers. And at that very night, two SS officers knocked at the door, having guns in their hands and forcing my grandfather to take down the white flag, otherwise they'd shoot him right away. And there are many examples that they did things like that, even one day before. But my grandfather was, of course, smart enough to say, okay, take it easy, I take it away. Next days, the Americans were there, the war was over, and things changed completely. So for this generation of my father and my mother, things changed with that days in May 45. And also the elder generation, on the side of those who had suffered a lot around Germany, and we being the bad guys, it was quite clear Europe couldn't go on like that. That was completely impossible. The devastation of this continent was so terrible that even the most militant people had a feeling that you couldn't go on like that forever. On the side of the neighbors of Germany, there was also another logic. They said, we have had Germany two times in 30 years that they have become too strong and then attacked neighboring countries. What can we do that it doesn't happen again? And the logic of after the First World War, just pushing the Germans down, taking away their military, didn't work. So they thought, we have to create a structure in which the Germans integrate, and in a way we can control them. And the best thing to start with would be the economy. Because, as you know, people who do trade with each other wouldn't shoot at each other. Very simple, but that's the case. So in 1949 and 1950, they started a very small union that only dealt with steel and coal and some basic things and the trade with that. And it was France and Germany and Italy and the so-called Benelux countries, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, who formed the first, let's say, the nucleus of the European Union. It was basically only a steel and coal union, but in fact, it was a project that was meant to be the nucleus of something much bigger. So I don't have very much time. I could tell you a lot about how this union then developed. But the basic idea that I would like to describe you today makes it easier maybe for me to jump a little bit. It worked very well. In 1957, we had the European Economic Union, a community. And this proved to be very successful so that neighboring countries started to wanting to join the union. So in 1972, even the British decided that they wanted to be part of the union. And let me make another jump right into the 80s. Then something, revolutionary happened. 1989, German reunification. I myself grew up 4 kilometers south of the border to communist Eastern Germany. As a kid in the 60s, I remember the sound of exploding mines. Can you imagine that through your home country there's a wall, and from our side you could visit the wall, you could step right and touch the wall from the western side. On the eastern side, you would have a strip where the mines were, barbed wires, shepherd dogs, soldiers with Kalashnikovs. And whenever somebody approached from the west, they would have their Googles and watch who is it and take notes. You could see that. So this border went right through Germany, and then all of a sudden this eastern communist part of Germany imploded in a way. Okay, the government there, they would have shot at their own people, I'm quite convinced, but at that time, fortunately, the Russian government, the Soviet government with Mr. Gorbachev, they decided to tell the East Germans they wouldn't help. So the Russian tanks would not roll in favor to protect the East German government. And then, luckily enough, the leading persons there were smart enough not to start shooting, but it was very close. So Eastern Germany imploded. The wall came down, and all of a sudden, in December 89, at demonstrations in the eastern part of Germany, you could see the first posters saying, we are one people, we are one people, meaning we want reunification. Okay, for me, it was maybe the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. I don't think that in one life you can have a greater experience than something like that. For our neighbors, it was a peculiar situation, because the old angst, that's a German word that you use in English, the old angst came up again. If you now go through the secret papers of the French and British government of that days, because now 20 years later we have access to some of the papers, you would see that Margaret Thatcher in England said, wow, Germany getting bigger of maybe by a quarter of its size, 17 million new inhabitants, they are getting too big again. This will cause problems. Now we have, again, a too big Germany in the center of Europe, and this will bring up the same problems that we used to have before. What can we do against it? And the French also, President Mitterrand, he was very reluctant, and maybe some of you who are historians remember that in December 89, the wall had already come down, the government toppled. He made a state visit to Eastern Germany in December 89. Which is a signal that he obviously favored a solution of keeping two German nations. Of course, they had fears because it was deeply rooted in the history of the 20th century. I have to say, at that point, the Americans were again very helpful. President Bush Sr. at that time, he was very clear on that point and said, it is a natural thing that the German people who wants to come together can come together. And if there's the opportunity, we'll be with you. So he had a very great impact on our British and French neighbors in the end to give in. As far as the Soviet Union is concerned, I think it was a very short window of opportunity where this country itself was so deeply into trouble that they simply let go. And we paid them well for that, I have to say that. So reunification came, and our neighbors were not very happy with it, in a way. So what can we do? Our Chancellor Kohl at that time saw that clearly, and he said, let's bring sacrifice for Europe as a whole. And at that time, this idea of her having, for example, this currency, joint currency, came up. Let's create a common economic market with a common currency. Because for our neighbors, this German mark and the strength of the German currency mark was a symbol of this strong Germany. And integrating this currency into a bigger currency for everybody gave them the feeling that Germany was then framed in and wouldn't pose any danger anymore. That's how the euro came into life. And the problems we're having now are more or less motivated by that process, how it came into life, because at that time the political will was so strong to create this joint currency that politicians were prepared to, not look so closely on the figures that were presented by some of our member states who wanted to become member of this zone. So, there have been made some mistakes in that process, but the political will, as I said, was too strong choose another way. And in the end, I would think that this euro project is a good project. It will help in the end. The problems we're having now, if I put it in a nutshell, is more or less like the measles. If the kids have the measles, it's a disease that we have to go through. And maybe we'll get out of that even stronger. Last week I was at UCLA, and there's Professor Ivan Behrendt, who is quite a famous economic and professor for economy and history. He presented a book about the EU crisis, and the interesting thing is his book is The Euro Crisis 2008 to 2012. I said, wow, that sounds promising. So you mean it's over? And he said it's not exactly over, but he's deeply convinced after the analysis he gave that we will come over that and maybe even emerge stronger than before. The bad news that you read and the image that you might have of this project not going very well. Let me give you another example. That brings me back to my basic idea. This year we will have a new member. Maybe you've heard that. July 1st, Croatia is going to join the European Union. You might think, are they crazy? A political project that's on the brink of disaster, that's not working very well. Some countries even breaking away maybe. And the Croats think about joining. If you would ask my Croatian colleague in Los Angeles, we have a consulate general of Croatia and a consul general there. He's a very impressive man. If you would ask him, he would say, of course we want to be a member. We are family. So for him, it's no question that these economic problems we are having are, of course, not easy to solve. But the project itself is so much bigger than that of course they want to be part of that. And don't forget, we've seen the last wars on European soil on the Balkans in the 1990s. That's not so far back. If you nowadays go to Croatia, Serbia, Montenegro, etc., you would find maybe nobody who has no memory of what has happened. some people wearing deep scars and maybe even wounds of what has happened only 17, 18 years back. So for them, the memory is so present still that this project of putting peace to a whole continent is really promising. So that's also what the Croatians say. Of course, we want to join. And we also would like to see the Serbians join and the Montenegrins and the others, because once all of us become members of the European Union, then the chance of another war there is almost zero. So, well, I personally hope that it was the last war on European soil, and if the project goes well, that this was then the end of wars in Europe. Okay, let me... you might think the guy is so enthusiastic, doesn't he see the problems? So, to balance this a little bit, let me give you what I see the two basic problems that the European Union now has. It's not the economy and it's not the money. It's something completely different. I told you when this union emerged in the 40s, 50s, there was a strong will that we have to get rid of war in Europe. And the young generation who had seen so many terrible things, they didn't want to have that again. Nowadays, if you talk to your generation in Europe, you'd find a completely different picture. Let's say 20-year-old, 22-year-old Germans, the lifestyle they're having now. Some of them don't even know what a passport is. Changing money? What's that? Why do I have to change money? Through the deregulation of the common economic market, airfares have gone down so much that it's now very easy to travel in Europe. So you find students who go to Barcelona to do a year in Spain, girlfriend being in Stockholm doing a year there, and over the weekend they meet in Brussels. Because you can fly with these cheap, for example, these Irish Ryanair, you can fly for maybe 30 or 40 bucks from Barcelona to Brussels, and then you meet there. So the lifestyle that is emerging there for them, it's so clear that this Europe is a whole and that you move hence and forth. And through the legislation that we have now in the Union, if you as a German go to France, you can easily pick up work, you can find an apartment, your ID is valid, your driver's license is valid. So all that works very well. Taxes, all that is no problem anymore because it has been harmonized. So moving in and out has become very easy. And for the young generation, this is a thing that simply is a fact. And they maybe forget a little bit about the sacrifice that had to be made to bring that into life. And I would say even how thin the ice is on that we are moving. That is one of the biggest problems for to make the younger generation conscious of how precious this project is and how much it needs the commitment and the enthusiasm of each single person living there. The other problem is, let me take a little curve now. I arrived in the US last summer, and it's my first time that I live in the US, and I watched the presidential campaigns, and of course, I studied a little bit what's happening here. And to my big surprise, I found, wow, there are so many similarities between this federal state of the United States of America and the European Union, both coming from different directions. But in fact, if you look at the facts, there are so many things in common. And even sometimes I think that the states of the United States are in a way politically much more different than the member states of the European Union. Let me just talk about the death penalty. You have states that in a very, very decisive question, is a human being allowed to kill another one, and is it justified or not? One of the most basic questions of mankind. Here you solve it completely in two completely different directions in two states. That is unthinkable in Europe. Brussels would say, no, we cannot have such different legislation in two different member states. Completely unthinkable. So in a way, you are more separate than the European states. But on the other hand, you have an elected president. You, the American people, elect a president as your representative in the world. Europe doesn't have a person like that. We have nobody who is elected by the people. We have our heads of state and heads of government that we elect, then go to Brussels, meet and discuss, but there's no president of the European Union. There's not one person, or let's say even one group, that is directly elected by the European people. So I would say a clear lack of democratization, democracy. We have the European Parliament in Strasbourg, but its role is still not quite decided, and its influence is not very clear. I'd wish they'd be stronger, but they are not. The real great decisions still are being made by the heads of governments and states when meeting in Brussels in very small circles and then hammering out something. So there is a lack of democracy, and if you speak to citizens of the European Union, many will tell you, I don't understand what's happening in Brussels. They are handing out their ideas, and there's new legislation coming from there. But I don't actually know who are the guys, who is deciding that, and what is my vote worth in that system. I would say that's a big problem. And if you look at the foreign policy and security policy here in the U.S., it's quite clear that the President of the United States is taking charge of that, foreign policy, security policy. In Europe, we have nobody who can decide on that. Let's go back 10 years. Some of you might remember when your country decided to go to war against Iraq, and then Europe was asked to go with the Americans. The Union simply broke up. The British and the Italians went with you. We did not, with good reasons, as I think. And the French neither went with you. So not even in that question, the member states could agree on a common line. And up to this very day, for example, if you look at our policy against Iran, you'd find within the European Union quite different points of view and quite different policies, which is, in a way, a weak point of the European Union as a whole. So that makes a real big difference to the United States. So, just to my last sentence, I sincerely wish that the miracle my grandfather witnessed in the early 90s loses not its meaning, and I sincerely hope that this experiment of putting a whole continent to peace will be successful, and maybe, if it is successful, give an example to other regions of the world that it is possible to overcome traditional animosities and find together to a harmonious life together. Thank you very much.
So we will now devote the remainder of time to questions. If you have a question, please speak clearly into the microphone, state your name and something about yourself.
Good morning. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate your presentations. My name is Ali. I'm a junior here at the University of Utah. My question is about the future. It's about more about the future of the European Union. You talk a little bit about the past and the history of European Union. I would like to know more about what do you think is going to be the future of European Union, let's say in 5 years or in 10 years, because I just read a news, as you say, the bad news, most of them are bad news about European Union, as I read that the British consider and start to rethinking their membership at the EU. I think it's really, really big news, because I believe that British is kind of a big members for the EU itself. So how do you see these problems, and how do you think the EU, especially the people in Brussels, will kind of solve this problem and, you know, to make the EU even better than now? Thank you very much. Vielen Dank.
Gerne, gerne. So, of course, I'm not a prophet, so talking about the future is hard. Well, I'm still convinced that the basic idea of this union will carry. And that the economic trouble we're having can be overcome. My friends in the Ministry of Finance, so some people I know that talk also informally with me, they say Greece is a problem. Greece is a real problem because the economic and political structures they're having are, wow, they have to be modernized a lot, maybe more than the people is prepared to go with its government. This is going to be hard. The other countries that are now in real trouble, like Portugal and Ireland, they will go through that. And even now, if you look at the figures, they are on their way up. They have seen, they have figured what their problems are, and they have even now tackled bold reforms in both countries, and that will go very well. So I think, all in all, the economic side is not so bad. The union as a whole, and if you look at the GDP of Greece compared to other countries, you will see in the end this can be done. You see, we help them a lot. I can tell you, I pay my taxes in Germany. I'm a German diplomat. I'm being paid in euros on my German account. I pay tax quite a lot compared to you. No, I would say half of my income is tax, and a portion of that goes to help the Greeks. And I say it's good money, well invested. The Greeks haven't done a good job, not at all. But the project is worth the money, I would say. Other Germans wouldn't say the same thing, but I'm convinced about that. The other, danger that you just mentioned about the British. The British are a very peculiar country, I have to say. Even before the financial crisis, very often it was not easy to deal with the British, because in my understanding, they put their national interests sometimes too strongly into negotiations and were not enough prepared to go into compromise, where other countries were prepared to do so. I'm not happy with that. And because I think we need the British. We need the British in the Union. And if I talk to my British colleagues, all the diplomats, everybody would say, of course we have to stay in the Union. But they are under immense pressure of some pressure groups there who push their government to do something. So in the population there, I would say there's maybe even a majority now against the Union. But if you talk to so-called elites, so business managers or government people, everybody would say, of course, we have to stay. And even here, your American president has said it in public that you prefer the British to stay. I would wish so too. But, well, it's democracy. And if the majority says you're going to go out, you're going to leave, and they're going to leave. But the consequences will be tough for them, for us too, but worse for them, I would say. I think this is not the way we have to go. And we have to solve our problems together. Well, that's in a good family. There are always some. Oh, thank you.
Your mic's been unplugged.
Oh, so in a family, you always have people who are getting along with each other better, and some not so good. And you just integrate and you find solutions, and that's the model maybe for us too.
My name is Matt Marcet. I'm a student. I'm a senior here at the U. And my question was about turnout in elections for the parliament are historically low. And I was like, how does the European Union plan to address that? What's the German government's role, and what does that low turnout mean for democracy in the EU?
Okay, a low turnout is not specifically a problem of the European Parliament. Your turnout here is not so high either, right? I've seen figures how many votes actually have been in favor of the president, and compared that to the whole population, it's not so many. Okay, that is how a democratic process is working. Those who don't want to participate, it's their own fault, I would say. It's their own fault. The problem is Europeans are used to having their politicians close to them, more or less. In the small countries, in Luxembourg, everybody knows the king and the prime minister, of course, personally. And still in the Netherlands, I'd be sure that two-thirds of the population have shaken hands with the prime minister once. So in Europe, we are very much used to having our politicians quite close, knowing who they are, having opportunity to speak to them. And, of course, that's very comfortable, and it's a very nice thing to have. But if you look at Germany, 82 million, so in my perspective, it gets a little more difficult. So I still know my member of parliament of the town where I come from. I know her personally. I've seen her. But more than that, it becomes difficult. And this union is such a big thing, and the constituencies are so big that it's very hard to get to a personal relation between you as a voter to your representative. That's a big problem. And I'm not sure whether it can be solved so easily. Because, as I said, we are used to being close to our politicians. And so this having them in Brussels so far away, I don't know, maybe the next generation gets used to that. For me, it's also difficult. But it's a problem, and, well, we work on that maybe through better communication. Well, now with all the social media we have, it makes it easier for politicians to communicate with their voters. But it's a problem, yeah.
Hi, I'm Deborah Christensen, and I'm a Californian who also resides here in Utah part-time. I'd like to go back to the economic issues of the EU. Greece has threatened to pull from the EU more than once. Problems with them is that they can't print their own currency to help themselves out of their own problems right now. The debt, funding of their debt shortfall came to a crisis point recently. Italy is in the same position. They're having 7% bonds, having to refinance them. That is a tipping point. What happens to the EU if Greece, Italy, or one other country pulls out of the EU? Will it survive? Will the currencies collapse?
Okay. I'm not an economist, and the details, I wouldn't dare discuss them because I'm not a specialist on that. But in general, I would say Italy is not the problem so much because the economic power of Italy is strong enough to go through that. I mean, look at Japan, 240% GIP national debt, 240%. They have a national budget that is not even covered by tax income by half. 30-something percent is only tax income. It should have exploded years ago, and it doesn't. It will at a certain point. I'm quite convinced of that, because no country can bear in the long run a national debt like that. But you see, this national debt question is closely linked to the economic power of a country. The yen did not fall, so investors still go into the yen because they think that Japan will go on successfully for a certain time. Same in Italy. Italy has the economic power. Greece is completely different because their industries are not very good. They haven't put enough energy into reforming their economic sector, and especially tax. The tax management in Greece is a complete disaster. We know that because the European Union, what do? They sent down German tax inspectors to help. Well, they are being greeted by Greek demonstrators as Nazis. Can you imagine? So as a historian, I know exactly why that is the case. But they are down there to help because maybe you've read the reports about Greek tax offices, how they're organized like in the Stone Age. And almost every rich Greek doesn't pay taxes, not at all. So they have to have strong reforms in order to reform, and then maybe they might emerge, but not at that point. So economic power is very weak in Greece. Fortunately, the Greek economy at all is not so big compared to the rest of Europe, so that still I think we can carry them and give them, provide them the time for reforms. But of course we expect them to tackle the reforms. And if you ask German citizens in the streets, they are not very happy that we help them so much, that we give so much money. But as I said, the project is much bigger than that.
My name is Park. I'm a political science major. So my question to you, do you believe European country will form a unified government in the future?
Unified government. That again, I'm no prophet. We are moving in that direction. But how do you say? Three steps forward and two back or something like that. That's the rhythm how we do it. For example, this deficit that we don't have a common foreign policy is very clear to everybody. So a couple of years ago, the heads of governments and states decided we need to have a representative of the European Union, kind of a foreign minister of the European Union. It was the Brits who opted against. It would have been the foreign minister, but the British said no. No foreign minister of European Union. We are not with you. So it's now the representative in foreign policy, and it's Lady Ashton, a British. It's interesting. So let's say the union tries to find positions, to find also people who can fulfill these positions, to build up personalities that can represent the union, like Lady Ashton. But in reality, if you look when it comes to, decision-making, you will find out that her role is not as strong. It's still the national governments who decide. Let's look at Mali. What do we do about Mali? It was, of course, it was the French who said first what they would be going to do, and others were invited to go with them. But it was not Lady Ashton who said the European Union will help. So this is a process that is going on very slowly because it means that the national states have to give away sovereignty for the British. For the British, it's very hard. For other countries, it's hard to give away sovereignty. Well, I don't know. We are moving in that direction, but very, very slowly.
Hi. My name is Nicole Goodrich, and I'm a sophomore, get my master's in social work. And my question is, in your opinion, what is your greatest concern for the future, whether here in the U.S. or your European Union?
Okay. One of the basic rules for a diplomat is never comment on the situation in your host country. I have my private opinion on that, and of course I do reporting for my government in Berlin. They want to have our opinion, of course. But with you, I cannot comment on your internal questions. Of course, I have my private opinion. I wonder, this political system is a very peculiar thing. For example, it's my private opinion. For example, for me, it's very hard to understand how you tackle the problems that the country has with only two political parties. There are so many topics with so many different points of view. All of them have the right to speak out and have to get into a process of discussion. With only two parties, for me as a German, we have five parties in parliament. The sixth was the Piratenpartei. Maybe you've read about that. Because a great chunk of German German people thought that this internet age hasn't reached the political parties yet. So all the young people who are in the internet, they thought, let's create a new party and put that topic on the agenda. So the Piraten Party emerged for 2 years, and now the other party saw, oh, it's a topic, can get me some votes. So they put it on the agenda too, and now the pirates are again falling. Maybe you've read that. We've had some elections in Niedersachsen last Sunday. The pirates fell down to 2%, so they're out of parliament. That means, of course, their process of becoming a decent political party did not go very well. And since they are very transparent, you could read everything in the internet, all the bad shit storms that happened. You wouldn't believe it. Well, it is their principle to be very transparent through the internet. So you could read every bad thing somebody said about somebody else. And for voters, that's not something they like very much. So they fell down. But basically, two parties, I would say, is not enough. That's the only point I would make about that. My greatest concern about the European Union is, as I said, that the younger generation might lose momentum, might think these things as self-evident, that having no war, no violence, no borders, no trouble whatsoever, and that, as I said, the ice is very thin, because civilizations are on very thin ice. I have served in Africa. I've seen what can happen if in states corruption takes over, if you have a democracy, but only on the surface, very well organized by the leading figures to hide how they steal the money of their peoples. If you have seen that, you appreciate double and even more what we have achieved in the Union.
All right. Hi, my name is Zachary Whalen. I'm a senior political science and history major here at the U. My question for you kind of deals with Turkey. I just want to see if you believe they're kind of going through this really long accommodation policy to try and get into the EU. Do you see them eventually as a member, and will that lead to maybe some other fringe states such as Morocco and Algeria joining, and what role will that have on the EU?
That's a good question. I would say the prophecy part of your question about Morocco and Algeria, I skip that. But Turkey, of course. Turkey is a very, very important topic. Turkey has tried to join the Union, although they are still quite far away from, maybe you've heard this, we use the French word, acquis. Acquis is, if you translate it, what we have reached. So everything what we have reached in, let's say, juridical questions, political questions, economical questions, there is, of course, there are common regulations for all member states. That is what we have reached in 30 years or 40 or 50 years. That's the acquis. So if you as a new state from outside, as Croatia, for example, want to become a member, then the European Union says, okay, here's the acquis. You have to adapt your complete legislation to this acquis of the European Union, which is a real challenge, because that means that parliaments of a country are more or less asked to accept legislation from outside for their own countries. With Croatia, this process is going very well. I think at that point, 18 or 20 chapters are still not closed. That means 18 to 20 questions. So they haven't reached the acquis, but we think until the 1st July they make it. We haven't ratified the treaty yet that they might come in. So the Germans are very... we are very late with that. The Turkish started to adapt, to reform their systems. But they were so far away that still there's much to do. I think it's very strange that this Erdogan government that, as you know, is a very religiously oriented Islamic party, and everybody had expected, wow, that would be a step back. But on the other hand, no. The reforms that the Erdogan government has realized are incredible. They have changed the country, but still they are quite far away from what the European Union expects. And let me just give you this one crucial question. What about Northern Cyprus? Northern Cyprus, a country that is only accepted by one other country in the world, and that is Turkey. All other countries in the world consider it to be an occupied part of Cyprus. And if you talk to the Turkish about that, the reactions are not very encouraging. So that is only one of the questions. And press freedom, for example, or the treatment of the Kurdish minority. Minorities are always a very strong point if you discuss with the state who wants to become a member. So the discussions will go on. I personally, I see great problems approach because, as you know, the population of Turkey would be the second largest in the Union once they joined, after Germany. That would mean in the parliament and in all the groups you find there, the Turks would be quite strongly represented. And as a new member state that has reached the acquis only recently, that would be very difficult. But of course, Europe has offered Turkey the member state status in 1964, and it still is at that point. And we will see what will happen.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Nina Harvey. I'm a French major with political science as a minor. My question has to do with the motives of creating the European Union to begin with. It was to contain Germany, mainly militarily and also economically. But from what I've seen and read, Germany is emerging as powerful economically today in the European Union. Mm-hmm. What can you say about that? How about the future? How are the neighboring nations feeling about Germany's newfound power once again?
Yeah. Thank you. That's a very good question. At one point, I would like to correct you a little bit. Containing Germany militarily, okay. Economically, I think basically the idea of our neighbors was containing Germany economically to make sure that a strong German economy would not result in a strong military and again in some aggression. The economy by itself is maybe not so the problem. Many of our neighboring countries have a lot of trade with us and are not so unhappy with Germany doing well economically. As far as the military is concerned, we have diminished our military after reunification considerably. So we don't have a draft system anymore. I think the Bundeswehr is now only a third what it used to be. And none of our neighbors is afraid of the German Bundeswehr anymore. We have even common units with the French, mixed with half of the education of our officers is done in the U.S., in New Mexico down there. So we are very much integrated in the NATO structures. And militarily, I would say you would find nobody in the neighboring countries who is afraid of Germany anymore. And I have to say that, I'm a bit proud of our chancellors that we had and also Angela Merkel. They've always done their very best, especially for the small neighbors we have. You know, that we are seeking the German-French friendship is in a way quite clear. We have to have that. That is the basic axis of this whole union. But of course we have to talk to the Luxembourgers and to the Dutch and to the Belgians. And for example, I know that Angela Merkel uses a lot of time to call the heads of governments of the small states and discuss with them what their opinion is. And for example, also if you look at the European Parliament and other groups there, how strongly represented the countries are. Germany is always underrepresented and Luxembourg is always strongly overrepresented, which is only fair because we have, 82 million and they don't even have 1 million, I think. So in a way, for the smaller countries, they are represented, their voice is being heard. And for example, now in this euro crisis, the Luxembourgish politician Juncker played a crucial role because he's such a strong personality. And since he's representing Luxembourg, he was considered to be somebody who is maybe on a neutral stance because their own interests are not so strong. So he could always moderate. So, and the Dutch, for example, now his successor will be a Dutch. So the head of the commission is a Portuguese. So the big countries tend to choose, interesting personalities of smaller countries to represent the union, just to show that small countries have their role, have their weight, and are being heard.
I'm Daniel Snow. I'm a junior in political science at the U. During economic crisis,
Where are you?
Over here.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I'm in the back.
Sorry.
During economic crises, political extremism usually becomes a problem, and nationalist causes in Spain and in the UK have led to referendums on independence in Catalonia and in Scotland. And so, my first question is: how do you think the European Union would deal with an independent Catalonia or an independent Scotland? And do you think that political extremism due to economic crises will inhibit the democratization of the European Union?
Yeah, thank you. Again, a very good question. That's also a very interesting development. There is in Brussels a Committee of the Regions, which is a political body within the European Union that is dealing directly with the regions. And I know from Germany that Bavaria, for example, they are being very strongly represented there, and they use this body to discuss with other regions and develop common projects. That's also something that emerged with the European Union, that the role of national states going down a little bit, giving the regions more space of maneuver, and they use it. That's the positive side. If I look at some regions trying to break away from their countries, I would say the even worse example is Belgium, which is a state on the brink of breaking up into two parts. And they are very close to that. I don't know about here, but when I served in Japan last year, there was an official representative of Flandern. They have their own logo. They have their own business cards. You wouldn't even read Belgium on the business cards of the guys. And so it has developed. This breaking up has developed quite a lot. And I don't know. For the European Union, I'm not sure whether this is a real problem. Because they would say, well, those are democracies. They have to decide by themselves. The peoples will decide how they organize themselves as long as they accept the acquis and behave well within the European family. There's no problem with that. I would say from the point of view of Brussels, that would be the common opinion, that they don't see a big problem with that. It's a problem. Well, you have that in England with the Scotch, and in other parts too. And maybe if, let's say, in Spain some part breaks away, it might encourage other regions to do the same, which would not be a very good thing. And maybe it loses its meaning more and more because this common self-consciousness gets stronger and stronger. I don't quite know what to make out of that. Political extremism, of course, is a problem. The European Union is a complex thing, and I told you about this lack of democracy. That makes it easy for populists to stand up and speak against the Union. Speaking against the Union is very simple, because it is a weak body and it moves back and forth, as I said, three steps forward and two back. It makes it very easy to make your jokes about that. Well, it will be a task to keep those under control.
This concludes today's Hinkley Forum. Please join me in thanking our guest.